Yeah, let me first thank you for the opportunity to tell about some of the results that I actually obtained with a number of them, mostly students, except for Salur, of both Hubert Salur and myself. So I realized that, of course, the subject of nonlinear Sitka models is a very ancient subject. In fact, last week at the Stanley Fest, I think the most ancient results of Stanley Mandelstam that were mentioned were related to this Turing sine Gordon duality. And that's actually something that's going to feature here in some sense at some very end of this. So that part is of course, yeah, as I said, almost prehistoric. The modern twist in the field is, of course, a superspace. And that means, to say that right away, that means a target space supersymmetry. So I'm interested in relativistic theories with target space supersymmetry, no world sheet supersymmetry. So let me say that. So the aim is study 2D sigma models with target space. And again, there will be no world sheet supersymmetry, and I know that in string audience that's usually a turnoff. But first of all, it's a challenge to put in some world sheet supersymmetry as well. I think there's actually some interesting things to discover. And on the other hand, it will actually be interesting to see certain similarities between models with target space supersymmetry and world sheet supersymmetry. Some of the features seem to sort of be similar. So. Anyway, so motivation for me, in fact, when I started this a few years ago, was in some sense related to the program of quantizing strings in ADS backgrounds. So that's certainly one of the motivations. Strings in ADS backgrounds. At the time, I think I was sort of convinced that one should try to do that covariantly and sort of kind of quantize relativistic field theories with all the supersymmetry that the models have. Of course, I have been sort of proven wrong to some extent in the meantime, but I still think it's kind of interesting to pursue this covariant approach. So that, of course, would relate to the pure spinner part and the attempt to quantize strings in ADS backgrounds covariantly. So when I started this, actually, I was still in Saclay, and I talked about a little bit about my interest to my colleagues in the hall. They come. So, and they said they had actually some experience with these models, and they had worked on them. And in particular, these were the condensed matter colleagues, and they had worked on these things in the context of disordered systems. So systems with random disorder. So that's another context in which these things appear. And so, but then to some extent, the condensed matter colleagues, I mean, they kind of discouraged me and said, these are really weird theories. So better don't touch them. And well, I mean, I didn't know much about supersymmetry at the time. So, but I remember that all my high energy colleagues would tell me that supersymmetry makes things much easier. And now the condensed matter theory told me that some of these theories turn weird whenever they're supersymmetry. So clearly there was something to look into. And I must admit that in the beginning I just hit on the weird stuff. And then over the last 3 years I sort of learned to hide that. And so today I hope there won't be too much weird things in this talk. So it actually turns out that there's also lots of nice things to say about them. And the weird things are also nice, but I guess you have to have a sort of twisted taste to appreciate that. So the focus today, except from focusing on the nice properties rather than the weird stuff, will be on scale invariant theories. So the focus today on quantum So, of course, I'm interested in the quantum properties of these theories, and in particular those that have preserved scale invariance in the quantum level. So that's fine with these two applications. Of course, the pure spinner models are CFTs, non-unitary CFTs with C equals zero. Also in the context of condensed matter system, that's sort of capturing universal features. That's really what you're interested in. So So then the first question is, how many interesting scale invariant theories do we know about that have target space supersymmetry? And so you can start making lists, and I'm only producing a very short part of that list now, namely those that are compact and have in a way no H flux, not even sort of fermionic H flux. So that's slightly goes away from these models that appear in the pure spinner context, because there's this fermionic Vesalmino term that's not going to be in the list I'm produced, but you could incorporate that quite easily. So it turns out that there's actually several families of exactly conformal theories with a continuous parameter and continuously varying exponents, very much like a free boson, where you have the radius parameter. That's a continuous parameter. Of course, that's a free field theory. That's not very interesting. But here there are examples where you have preserved global symmetries and still a continuous volume parameter, basically. And so the two families there's actually two families in the compact case when you want compactness, which of course is also something that you don't want when you think about ADS, but it makes it a bit simpler here. And this is a coset family, so it's OSP 2S plus 2 2S divided by OSP 2S plus 1 2S. So these are coset models. They actually have a geometry of a sphere with an odd number of bosonic dimensions and an even number of fermionic direction. So these theories are examples of this family. So this gives actually conformal field theories of C equal central charge equal 1. And then there's a second family, UNN divided by UN minus 1 N cross UN. And that's gives complex projective spaces of any dimension with a certain number of fermionic directions. So this gives actually conformal field theories of central charge minus 2. Okay, so that's the two families. Now notice that these are, actually when you think about it, these are of the type G, where G is either OSP 2S plus 2 2S or UNN divided by, well, the fixed point set under some Z2 action. So these are symmetric superspaces. And so by standard results, they are integrable. In fact, there's more integrable examples starting with these supergroups, but they are not conformal. So these are the only ones that actually are conformal. So what's special about this supergroup? I should mention that, I mean, these two supergroups and sort of non-compact versions thereof, they appear in all these conformal cosets that are what's special about them is that the dual Coxeter number of these things is actually exactly zero. And the dual Coxeter number is, in a way, a measure for the amount of non-abelianness, if you want. So how is it defined? I mean, you take the structure constants of the Lie algebra, or Lie super algebra, and you contract them in all the indices, okay? So that's the value of the Casimir and the adjoint representation. And for these two super algebras, that number is zero. So to some extent, sort of the norm of the structure constants is zero, if you want. So there's a... So that's sort of a distinguished feature. That can you just read this? OSP. S equals 0, not the same for U. So, and in fact, that's a very crucial property when you want to prove conformal invariance. But it's not the only important thing. It does not work with all GZ2 that you get conformal invariance. There's a bit more conditions. So you can extend this, as I said, to non-compact cases and also to Z4 orbifolds, which are the ones that appear in string theory. Then you have these fermionic Vesalmino terms. That's not such a difficult. Yes. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of examples with Lorentzian, one time or more times or whatever.
Special about those denominators that you chose?
As I said, what you do in the program that you do is, I mean, you look for all Z2 automorphisms, then you write down everything that you can get as a fixed point of Z2 automorphisms, and then you have to study which of them are conformal. And actually, there is an extra condition. There's actually one extra parameter here that when you don't require conformal invariance, just integrability, classical integrability. But quantum conformal invariance sort of fixes it, basically, to just this one parameter family in each case. So I can talk about the conditions more, but so the denominators are sort of special, yeah. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, a systematic study for higher order morphisms hasn't been done, but of course it's believed that we know of examples where we see four automorphisms that occur generalized symmetric spaces in a way. So I think there should be a similar list, but it hasn't been. Yeah?
We haven't left tried chiral algebras?
No, I'll come to that. I mean, these are conformal field theories, but not of the type that conformal field theorists usually like. So this is also, of course, a right coset. It has nothing to do with, there's no levels, no Vesomino model, no GKO construction or whatever. So concerning integrability, I already mentioned, I mean, there's classical results that guarantee that these things are classically integrable. And in fact, they were adapted to the super context by Bejnar, Polchinski, and Reuben, as you all know. So that works out. Quantum integrability is a more tricky issue. In fact, these supersphere models, I think quantum integrability you can do by these counting Goldschmidt-Witten-like counting arguments. So that goes through. For the CPN minus one N models, actually it also fails. So, but of course we know that even when you also in the case that you have target CPN models with worldsheet supersymmetry, this Goldschmidt-Witten-like counting fails, but still the models are integrable. So we believe that these theories are integrable. But there's no S matrix known for these theories at this point, and also this aspect hasn't really been addressed.
So there could be counterterms, but they just have zero coefficients.
That could be right. I mean, so the counting gives the same issue. I mean, in principle, there could be an anomaly in the quantum case, but for some reason, it doesn't seem to appear. So that's the same actually in the models with worldsheet supersymmetry. That's the same story, and still they are integrable. So that's not an argument against integrability, I think. Probably they're integrable. No, I don't think it has been checked, actually. I don't think it has been checked.
What's the definition of quantum integrability?
Well, I mean, okay, so that's the first or whatever, infinite number of conserved quantities or something. So we'll get to the other integrability versions later. Okay, so anyway, even if these models are integrable, as we know, they might be still very hard to solve, and that kind of comes back to the question we just had. I mean, these are conformal field theories, but there's no chance to solve them by the standard algebraic tricks of conformal field theory. There's just not enough symmetries on the worldsheet. There's no Kac-Moody algebras that would allow you to solve these models, so you have to actually turn to something else.
Why was it hard to find the S-matrix? Was it difficult to find?
I think there's probably candidates. Yeah, I think one should just look into these things. It has just not been studied enough, I think, to really know. So the program that we actually addressed then was to go be a little less ambitious and not trying to solve them, but first look for some kind of dualities. Or ask the question, so now we have these conformal field theories, they have one continuous parameter, and we can ask, are there certain points in the moduli space which are exactly solvable? And by exactly solvable, I mean sort of where we can actually compute answers explicitly, all answers explicitly, and preferably even using the techniques of conformal field theory or free field theory. So the question is, are there exactly solvable points in the moduli space? And that would give rise to some dual descriptions. Of course, we can do all kinds of computations in large volume because we can do sigma model perturbation theory, but we can ask, are there other points in moduli space? Well, we can also do all sorts of computations and perturb around. So that's similar when you think of Calabi-Yau compactifications. I mean, we can do lots of computations in large volume, but then we also know of these Gapner points where we can, in principle, do conformal field theory computation. That gives rise to sort of dual description of Calabi-Yau compactification. A similar question, I think, you can ask here. So in fact, to some extent, in the ADS context, because of ADS-CFT duality, we sort of guarantee that such points exist, because we have very efficient, we can, for instance, count operators in Young-Mills theory through these unitary matrix models, and some ADS-CFT, I think, guarantees that we should be able to reproduce that for a two-dimensional counting, of course, in Young-Wills, it's a four-dimensional counting of in four-dimensional field. So somehow, I think we're guaranteed that such points should exist, in particular, sort of the dual of free Young-Wills should be of this type. So that should be enough for introduction.
Such points should exist.
No, but of course, I mean, the dual is a string theory, and there should be a worksheet description also of the dual theory. And if we can count operators on one side, namely in the gauge theory, then we should be able to reproduce that counting of states, for instance, right? I mean, well, okay, let's say, I mean, okay, it's an indication that things like, I'll give you more indication as we go. So now I guess I'm ready to tell you a little bit more about the work. So at this point, I think there's no universal view on these dualities. So we basically approach these things model by model, and studied these dualities of solvable points in these two examples. So I'll start actually discussing the supersphere case, and I'll discuss such dualities in the supersphere case, and then if time permits, I'm actually not sure, do I have a blackboard bonus? Or is it an hour and a half?
This is a pedagogical talk, clearly. So.
Okay, so then we'll probably have time to do the... So the first part, I'll just talk a little bit about superspheres, then I'll show you sort of one of the tricks from my back and to show you how we address the issue of dualities in that context, and then I'll talk a little bit about CP models. Okay, so part one is the chiral field. On the supersphere. So let me just introduce a bit of. So we have a matrix that is G, that is the identity matrix with 2s plus 2 entries here, and then I have 0, 0 there, and then here I have identity matrix S here, so that's off diagonal. So that's. Let's see, getting quite some entertainment here. So that's it's sort of the metric that we use in order to write down the conditions. So the supersphere with an odd number of bosonic directions and an even number of fermionic real directions is sort of the set of all points. We call them X, which is a multiplet composed of 2s plus 1, 2s plus 2 bosonic, real bosonic coordinates, and 2s fermionic coordinates, such that, they satisfy this x alpha is equal to, I call this quantity rho squared, and I set this equal to 1. So that's the supersphere. It just has a few more odd generators. That's the only bosonic sphere. And so, as I mentioned before, this space here can be described as such a coset space. That's obvious from the construction, because obviously it's constrained. You have an action of OSP 2S plus 2S on this space. It's consistent with this constraint. And sort of if you take like one particular point from this set, it's left invariant by this denominator. So that's how you see that this is actually such a coset. So the corresponding sigma model has the action R squared divided over 2 pi. So R squared is this one coupling constant that is free. And then, of course, we have G alpha beta, Gx alpha, G bar, X beta. And then there's the constraint, which I can put in through a Lagrangian multiplier if you want, O squared minus 1. So that's the model. Okay, and now you can go ahead and compute. In this case, I mean, I told you it's going to be conformal. You can actually compute the beta function here explicitly. You can also do it. And so it actually turns out that contribution to the beta function, I mean, the bosons and fermionic contribution cancel pairwise. So the computation, when you think about it, as long as you don't have any extra insertions in your theory, I mean, like when you compute a beta function, then this is actually the same computation that you do when you compute the beta function for S1, and that, as we know, is zero. So what we see here is that we get a one-parameter family of CFTs with C equal 1. Of course, in the S1 case, that's a trivial theory. It's a free field theory. For S non equal 1, that won't be a free field theory. It's an interacting theory. And of course, it's non-unitary, obviously, because C equal 1 and then all these field contents are non-unitary. OK, so that's the model that we set out to study. And now, so still somehow this case S equal 1, the U1 boson is a special case of it. Let me just recall once more, I mean, we've seen that last week, one feature of this model, namely that there is, well, this chiral field on S1 is dual to this massless Turing model. And so the dual description involves, if you want, one complex fermion or two real fermions. So so that's, so you have, let's say, two real fermions. Let me call them A d bar psi A plus A d psi A bar. So that's the kinetic term. And then, of course, somehow the parameter has to come in. And that's now the coefficient of a fourth order interaction. So you have plus lambda and then psi a psi bar a squared. So that's the way you describe that. And there's a relation between this parameter lambda and the parameter r. And that relation is that r squared is equal to 1 plus lambda. So lambda equals 0 when this theory becomes free corresponds to r equal 1. That's sort of the free fermion point of the sigma model, and r to infinity corresponds to lambda to infinity. So now you can wonder, I mean, that something like this also works for our for the more general case. Yeah, it's from the point of the sigma model, it's of course strong weak coupling. I mean, this parameter r is really the sort of the radius in the model. So so in this description here becomes free somewhere deep in the stringy regime. So it captures all the alpha prime corrections. So it's actually, that's why somebody, I mean, here it's of course not very useful because the theory is solvable anyway, I mean, everywhere. But of course in the more general context, that is a much more non-trivial statement. So now you can actually go ahead and wonder whether you can do something like this. For this S non equal one, okay, and so yeah, actually, when I gave I talked about this a few months ago, I think, in Florence, and had it all in PowerPoint, quite nice. And so for some reason, when I flashed, I mean, put up the transparency with this dual model, PowerPoint decided to just blank out the answer. And although I had put it in, I still don't know what happened. But I thought it was actually quite smart. That PowerPoint would actually sort of challenge the audience a bit to think about an answer. So maybe I should now try to do the same and let you guess what the answer is.
Before proceeding, how many fermions?
A. Oh, A. So A runs from 1 to 2. So these are real fermions. I mean, often it's written with complex fermions, but here I decided to put it with real fermions. So these are have conformal dimension 1/2, that's C equal 1/2. So there are two of them, so that adds up to C equal 1, so that's nice. So the proposal, okay, you're all thinking, I guess. And the proposal is that this chiral field on the supersphere will be dual. I mean, that might not give it away to many if I write it now, to an OSP to S plus 2 to S Grossman-Mill model. Well, obviously, there's at least one person in the audience that knows now what what your discussion is. So let's guess what the field content will be. So you see, in this case, we had two real fermions. Okay, so that corresponded to the case where we had sort of two real bosons in this trip. So let's try to take 2s plus 2 real fermions, A, where now A runs from 1 to 2s plus 2. So these have h equal 1/2. Okay, so and then what do we do with our, that's sort of the new part now. We have fermions here. So what happens to those fermions in the dual description? Well, any proposal? They should become bosons, yeah. So let them become bosons. So gamma I. So, but in order to preserve symmetry, they better be bosons with conformal dimension 1/2. So, so that's, I mean, when you think of bosons and beta gamma systems, I guess there is a way to, in a beta gamma system, to make a beta gamma systems of bosons 1/2. And I guess when you look into the books, then you will find that this corresponds to C, so beta gamma systems with C equal minus 1. Okay, that's the case when the beta and gamma have sort of the same dimension. And that this actually, luckily, it's also 1/2. So we have S of those, that gives us our 2S bosons. And now we add up our central charge, so that is 1/2, because each of these real bosons has central charge 1/2. Then we have 2S plus 2 of those. And then from here we have S times minus 1, and that should give 1. Okay, so that's actually quite promising. So we found the description that has the same central charge. And so let's now write down the theory. So the theory would be S. So this is now the Gross-Navier description. And so here we have psi. Okay, let me put all of them into one field so that I don't have to write too much. So this contains now these fermions and the beta gamma system. And so this will then be alpha d bar psi alpha plus psi alpha d psi alpha bar. Okay, so that's a free theory, so that contains both the real fermions and the beta gamma system. And now about the interaction. Well, of course, there's several ways to think, but of course the natural thing is to also make that fourth order. So to add to this psi alpha bar squared. I'll say a little bit more about this. So we have a free part here. That's S cross Navier 0. And then this part here would be the interaction. Okay, so proposal is that this is a dual description. So it becomes, that should be, of course, a parameter lambda, and that we would have the same relation as in this case, between the radius and the parameter lambda. So again, that would be, if true, it would be a strong recoupling duality, because this theory becomes free at r equal 1, lambda equals 0. So
again, the beta function is 0?
Beta function is 0, yeah, you can also check that. So that's another nice test. I mean, at least we're not completely, so naively, of course, the theory is scale invariant, but yeah, that is, it's not broken by quantum effects also in this model, so that's the next check that you can do.
Largest number?
Sorry? Yeah, I think you can also study large S limit. I think for some reason, I mean, it's a technique that hasn't been applied very much in this context, but in principle, I think that might be something. Of course, yeah, in the old, days, I think this large N limit was a very good tool to study these properties.
On both sides, it should be a very
yes, absolutely, yes. But I'll give you very convincing evidence in a moment. So this is not in my bag of tricks, this large S limit, so that's why I'll give you a different theory.
With large S, I'm not sure if large S limit works right, though, because the vacuum bubble, you know, this cancellation between S and minus S, so it doesn't get large the way it does in the bosonic.
Right. Yeah, so somehow it's not so clear that large S limit, because you somehow, you stay at central charge equal 1, so somehow you...
Yeah.
I would
certainly for the beta function, that's true.
Yeah. Yes.
For any group singlet auxiliary field. Okay.
Yeah, I honestly haven't thought much about it.
There's still the largest expansion, one by order. That's interesting.
Yeah.
It just means.
But the usual thing in simple, which is that the auxiliary fields have a rate action. And the order is expected action.
Maybe we can do 2s plus 2 and 2s prime and later.
Yeah, I mean, then of course you have massive theory. So that's a possibility to kind of go into the massive version. So yeah, I don't have much to say about it because I haven't really thought too much about it. But there might be something there to be done. So let me just make a few comments on this. So there's this one point in moduli space, lambda equals 0, or r equals 1, when this piece isn't there, then you have a free field theory. And of course, at this particular point in the theory, you have the current algebra symmetry, an affine symmetry. So some of the picture is that everywhere in this moduli space, I mean, you have basically just Virasoro algebra, but then there's this one point where you have this enhanced symmetry. So at this point at lambda equals 0, you have an OSP 4 to affine symmetry at level k equals 1. And so it turns out at this particular point, all the currents that generate the OSP symmetry, they're all holomorphic. So you have the currents Jn, n runs from 1 to, sorry, why did that suddenly, it runs over all directions in Lie super algebra, so that's fermion and bosonic currents. And of course, as in the simple case, this interaction term is just the current-current interaction added. So the S interaction, can be written in terms of these currents, and it's just the current-current interaction, where you sum over all directions. Okay, so that's maybe just a comment. So I should say that this duality was first proposed by Kandu and Saler about a year ago. And what they did is actually they had a lattice description. So they found a very smart way to put this theory in a lattice. And then they did numerical computations in particular. And they could just show that sort of the spectrum really seemed to agree with the spectrum of the free Grosz-Naville model at one particular point and the one of the Sitka model in large volume. So I can just briefly tell you about the lattice model, although this is not my main topic.
Sorry, for this Grosz-Naville, you do have an S matrix, right? And bit equation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
Well, okay. Yeah, I mean, in principle, there's candidates. In fact, yeah, we can talk about the story with S matrices maybe later. I mean, I think there's things to say, but it's also they're not completely understood for me. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly candidate S matrices in this case. In fact, there's
a candidate. You said this model is conformally invariant.
Yes. Well, I mean, you have a massive. There's an easy way to make it massive, I guess, if you go with OSP. I mean, unless, well, the second index. So we have, of course, OSP M to N models, and they are normally massive, and so they have an S matrix, and then you can take the limit. Well, okay. I think that's something that probably. Has been cited. So in principle, of course, the S matrix still makes sense, and there have been attempts to kind of obtain the spectrum back from that. So
it's messy. But you could also write it directly by linear mass in the Grosz-Naville form, right? I mean, is that
yeah? That's another issue. I mean, again, I don't. There's one way, obvious way to make this view massive at the mass term. Whether this So again, I think it's not really known whether that theory in particular is integrable. I think some people would suspect that it actually is no longer integrable because somehow when you add the Grosz-Naville model explicitly mass terms, you might destroy integrability. So again, it's not quite clear. But there's, as I said, there's actually even to some extent two candidate S matrices in this case. And I think that's also an issue that should be sorted out somehow. But again, I mean, we will proceed along a different route. But so. I was just mentioning that there's lattice models. Let me briefly talk about them. So in fact, they're put together from three types of operators. So basically, you build this long spin chain. You put the fundamental representation and the anti-fundamental representation alternating along that spin chain. And then you have operators. Well, the identity operator, it basically takes two neighboring spins and maps them identically to two neighboring spins. And you can have the permutation operator, that or graded permutation operator that permutes neighboring objects, and then you can have another object sort of caps off two neighboring spins and then recreates something like this. I guess it's sort of obvious what I mean in terms of linear maps. And so then you can write down the following Hamiltonian. Depending on one parameter, again, someone will always have to have one parameter because we want to capture this R or lambda. 1 plus lambda over 2, and then we put sum here over lattice points, I to 1 to L minus 1, to L lattice points. So then we have I plus P, Pi here, and then the second term would be 1 minus delta over 2, and then here sum over EI, I to 1 to L minus 1.
Is this a naive discretization of your Hamiltonian? Is that, can we read it that way?
I think some things that you can see is, I mean, one constraint that you would want to have, some of these models, the S equal 1 model, S equal 0 model is sort of contained here as a subset sector as a theory. So you would want to have some Hamiltonian that reproduces the XXZ Hamiltonian in that particular limit. And so then there's actually one very nice universal form. In fact, this Hamiltonian works for all S. So just somehow these become different. So this universal form to extend from S equal to 0 to higher order. So the relation between delta and R is then given by this formula. So we see that delta equal, so R squared equal 1 corresponds to, so delta equal minus 1, so minus 1. So in that case, we don't have this piece, so there's no kind of crossings of this type, so it's only these models. So somehow we have no crossings of four four-point vertices, if you want. We only have loops in this case. And then somehow the claim is that going away from this free Grosvenor point is described by switching on the possibility of putting in such crosses. Okay. So anyway, so this model can be studied, I mean, algebraically and on numerically.
Sorry.
Yes.
You gave me delta and R, not between delta and lambda. So you're.
Yeah, but lambda and R are related.
So you're assuming that.
Yeah. So I should have said that here. So that's part of the part of the conjecture is that the relation here is the same as before. R squared is equal to 1 plus lambda. Okay. So anyway, so they have done all these numerical simulations. They plotted eigenvalues of states, and they could very nicely see how the spectrum of one model for a few low-lying states actually reproduced the other state. So that's convincing, relatively convincing, I guess. So okay, so that brings me sort of to the exposition of the statement. And now, as I said, I wanted to show you one of the tricks from my bag of tricks. How I understand and can sort of derive this duality now. And that's sort of the next part. So unless there are more questions on what I've just talked about. Let me start raising this. So that runs under the name of quasi-Pimpian. Okay, that doesn't say much at this point, but I'll hopefully make that clear as we proceed.
Do you have a similar dual model candidate for the super?
Okay, well, we have a bit more time, right? I mean, so we'll get to that point later. But, So the first thing that you can do is actually you can take the theory in a large volume, R equal infinity, and you can start doing state counting. I mean, it's free at that point, so you can certainly just do the combinatorics for your state counting. And so I'll do that state counting here for boundary conditions, so I have Neumann boundary condition. That makes it a little easier to count states of the two-dimensional theory because you have only one derivative, namely along the boundary. And not two derivatives. So counting in for closed states is a little more cumbersome, but in principle straightforward. So let's do that. So the states of the chiral field. So I'll do everything in this section just for S equal 1, so the first non-trivial case. So the rest gets more complicated. And to be quite honest, we haven't done the full analysis, but I think it's already quite convincing to see how it works in this case. So we impose Neumann boundary condition. some of this is now a free sphere, and sort of we have a brain wrapping the full free sphere, because we have no NS flux here, that's possible. That's I mean, if we have inverse amino models, we can't have that, but here it's consistent. So they are counted. So when I mean the fields, I mean basically you imagine we have these basic fields, the basic multiplet that I call the X alpha, and I consider basically all polynomials in X alpha and all its derivatives, and that's what I want to count. So that's a fairly easy exercise. So first of all, you can count all the things that have no derivatives. So let me call that zero. So when there are no derivatives, you see we have two fermionic generators in this case and four bosonic generators. So, and then there's also, I guess there's sort of three charges in the theory, because OSP42 in this case has three Cartan elements. And so we can sort of give pairs of the pair of fermions and each pair, I mean, pairs of bosons, individual charges, and count including those charges. And so then the fermions contribute something like, so the fermion charge I could call Z1, or basically count with Z1 to 1/2, so these are 1/2 objects, and times T, so that comes from fermionic generators, minus 1/2 times T, and then we have four bosonic generators, one minus, and they have, I mean, I can assign two charges to them, so we have 1/2 V3, 1/2 T, and so there's four such factors. Let me just write one more, and then maybe 1/2 C3 minus 1/2 T, and then 1 minus C2 minus 1/2 C3 minus 1/2. So that would be just counting sort of the number of things without taking the constraint into account, obviously. If there was no constraint, that would be the answer. Because there is a constraint, we can multiply this now with 1 minus T squared. That's why I put in the T in the first place, and then set T to 1 again. So that takes care of the constraint. So that's the way you can count very easily the zero mode part.
Why do we define the charges to be a half?
Okay. I don't know. I agree it would be easier to have an integer. That was sort of my normalizations of all the Cartan generators. So then you can do the same for the full spectrum, including derivative fields. And so the theory has central charge one, so there's this standard factor, then there's of course all the contributions from the non-derivative fields, and then there is an extra piece, I'll talk about this in a moment, that's the Euler Q function, and then we have basically a similar counting to here, but now for the descendant field, the derivative field, so the fermions contribute with 1 plus that 1/2 U to the N, 1 plus that 1 minus 1/2 U to the N. N runs now from 1 to infinity, one derivative to infinity many derivatives. And down here, well, you can guess what it is. So that's the same thing with T replaced by Q to the N. That will do the state counting. So what's this? What's the Euler function here that's put in? So remember, we have this constraint. And this construction here takes the constraint, implements the constraint on the level of zero mode, some of the global part, and this Euler function sort of does the local part. So that just removes sort of locally one direction. Okay, and that's what the Euler function here counts. So that's the way, so in this way, for these two parts, the constraint is implemented on the entire state space. Okay, so that was easy enough.
Sorry, can you
explain it again? So the Euler function, the purpose of this factor of the Euler function is to take away basically one bosonic direction locally, right? So you see we have this constraint in the model. Where is it? This constraint in the model. And when we do our state counting, we have to implement this constraint globally and locally, right? So globally it's done here on the part of the zero modes, and locally you just get it by multiplying with this Euler function. Okay. Anyway, you can play with this formula and convince yourself that it does the state counting correctly. So then you can also start expanding this, I mean, to just as a check that you have not made mistakes. So you get Q to the minus 1 over 14. And then there is, of course, a vacuum in there. And then you find the next thing would be sort of the contribution from the fundamental field multiplet, which also has, of course, dimension zero, so it comes without any extra Q power. That's the fundamental, that's the character, sort of the fundamental representation that appears here. Then the next thing that you get is the character of the 18-dimensional representation of OSP42. Again, all these fields have dimension zero, and that continues. There's infinitely many states, of course, of dimension zero, just say non-derivative fields. And then you have, you start with fields that have one derivative, and the first multiplet is, of course, transforming in the adjoint. That would be sort of the currents, and so on and so forth.
This is calculation of free field?
Sorry?
This is calculation
of free field? So, yeah, so we are at the R to infinity limit. So it's just very simple state counting. I mean, just a little bit of combinatorics. There's nothing non-trivial here. So, and that's, you can check that this is really what you would expect.
14 is coming forward.
Sorry?
14? Where is 14?
14, 14, 14, 14. Oh, sorry, 24. Or at least, good. Somebody's paying attention. So, okay, so that was the state counting up there. And now we could have the idea to do the same state counting somewhere at the Gross-Neville point. And of course, we would expect to get something very, very different, right? So let's do the state counting at the Gross-Neville point. And I mean the free sort of free Gross-Neville point when lambda is equal to zero. So the other case where we can do easy state counting, and then all everywhere in between, it seems pretty hopeless. So at least for now. So free Gross-Neville. In fact, again, we have to put some boundary conditions because we studied the boundary point. And so we would want to study some boundary condition that preserves the OSP42 symmetry, because otherwise we don't expect there would be any relation. Now, fortunately, it turns out that there's actually a unique boundary state that preserves the OSP42 symmetry. That kind of fits nicely with the fact that also in the geometric, in the Sigma model, somehow there's only one. I mean, in order to preserve the symmetry, the brain has to fill the entire volume. So there's only one such thing. So at least the brain counting also seems right. So that's also quite reassuring. So it has a unique boundary state. With J n equals say bar n along the boundary. And so you can do the counting. I spare you the details. I mean, you know, of course, whenever I do counting, and so here we have an OSP affine symmetry. Affine symmetry, so we can in principle do the counting quite easily, and you know there will be lots of theta function. Whenever you write down characters of affine representations, you can express that in terms of theta function. So I'll just give you the answer. And so this is at the free Gross-Neville model. So the answer is, theta 3. That's the answer. If you write it, it's actually a sum of two characters of affine representation of the affine algebra. So that can be worked out. I think that's a standard stuff. We won't bother too much about it. So again, you can do the expansion of this thing. What you find is, of course, 2 to the minus 1 over 24 again. And then you find a unique vacuum state. So then, of course, you find the field multiplet of the size and gammas, so they appear at dimension 1/2, so you get Q to the 1/2 times the character of the fundamental multiplet, then you get a Q to the power 1, you get the adjoint, that's the currents, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's what it looks like. So you might wonder, how are these two things related? You see here you have an infinite number of dimension 0 states. Here, I mean, there's only one, and then it goes up, right? So So they don't seem very related. Of course, we also don't really expect first sight that they would be very related, because we're doing a very different counting problem, one in sort of strong coupling, the other in weak coupling, in different regimes. So there should be a complicated relation between the two. So this is now where this notion of quasi-Boolean evolution comes into the game. So my claim will be that actually there is a very nice relation between the two.
Why is there infinitely many dimensions zero?
Oh, because you have infinitely many non-derivative fields in the theory, right? You have the fundamental multiplets. I mean, all polynomials in the fundamental multiplets have dimension zero if you add r equal infinity.
I see.
So that's the counting problem. So now you remember, I mean, our model is a closed relative of a free boson in some sense. It's non-interacting, but it's still a relative. So let's look at the issue of how conformal dimensions for a free boson change as we change the radius. And so for the free boson with boundary, in the bulk case, it's slightly more complicated, but also not much. The idea is the same. So you can take a field, any field in your theory, let's call it phi, and try to compute the conformal dimension of that field at radius r. Okay, how do you do this? Suppose you know the dimension of that field at r equal infinity. So then actually it's quite easy to do that, because all that happens is that, well, you make the radius, give it sort of finite volume, so you get a contribution that depends, of course, somehow on the momentum, right? And so the contribution will be, let me just erase a bit more so that we have more space. So the contribution is basically a function depending on the radius times some U1 charge in the theory, which is sort of, for instance, momentum or winding, depending on what kind of boundary condition I impose, to the second. So that's doing it. And this function f of r here is universal. It depends on the boundary condition that you impose, but it does not depend on the field. And the only field dependence of this correction comes through this U1 charge. So this is, I mean, again, in the free boson, it's kind of standard. I mean, it's basically telling if you have a state describing a particle moving on a circle at infinite radius, has energy, sort of scale energy zero, and then when you go to finite radius, then of course the correction is basically momentum squared times 1 over r squared or something, or 2 over r squared, depending on normalization. So that's more or less what I'm saying. So just imagine that we could use the same formula in our interacting case. And I'll say something about this in a moment. So the proposition is that we can do something like this for boundary theories in this. That we could use a similar formula, that we could actually compute dimension of a field at radius r by taking the dimension at r to infinity, then add universal function of the coupling r times, well, I mean, we don't have a distinguished U1 charge, so what we will do is, of course, take the quadratic Casimir of OSP of the particular multiplet. Imagine they're all transforming in multiplets of OSP 4-2, and add this. So this is the quadratic. So that's a proposal. So could we actually believe something like this would be true? So in fact, formulas of this type have first, I think, appeared in some work 10 years ago by Bereshatsky and collaborators. And I think about a year ago, we readdressed this issue sort of more systematically, particularly in Vestomino models. And so I don't want to give you too much of details, but roughly kind of some feeling what's happening there. So conformal dimensions are sort of scalar quantities. And when you in perturbation theory, when you want to compute a scalar quantity and you do perturbation theory, of course you see lots of terms that have to do with the curvature, with the FABC basically that we have in the sort of coming from the curvature of the background. However, when you try to put FABC together to a scalar into a scalar, I mentioned that these particular supergroups, they are somehow non-abelian, but to some sense, when you look at scalar quantities, they look very abelian, okay? Because FABC multiplied with FABC summed over ABC is always zero. So what actually happens is when you do a perturbation theory in these models, that all these curvature-related terms, when you do it for conformal dimensions, they all drop out. And so basically, you can sum the perturbative expansion and get an answer that looks like for a free field theory. So that also tells you you cannot do that with correlation functions, for instance. Correlation functions are not scalar quantities, so that they will have a much more complicated behavior. But for conformal dimensions, actually, it works. So there's some caveats to this statement, but in zero for approximation, that's actually sort of a good intuition.
So I mean, another way you might think, I mean, there are some questions that are purely restricted to an SO2 subgroup where everything else manifestly cancels. This is not that simple.
No, I think here there are lots of multiplets that don't sit in this,
right.
So it's an extension of that. Yeah.
That
Why
only quadratic reasoning?
That's what comes out of the perturbation theory, if you want. So we call this quasi-abelian evolution of conformal weights, and that's
this is still a conjecture.
So for the models that we talk about, we've proven it for both in the Sicker model perturbation theory and also coming from the Gross-Navier point. So I think we have sort of, in certain cases, in particular coming from Bessel-Minow models, we have a more general picture when this actually holds and when it does not. So I think, I mean, here it's certainly not a conjecture. It's exactly proven. So let's do an example of this, and then let's readdress this issue here. So one example. Let's take the fundamental multiplet of our large volume description, so that I called X. Well, this is X alpha Xi multiplet. So according to this formula, in order to compute this, the dimension at radius r, well, we take the zero, that's its value conformal weight at infinite radius, then plus this function f of r, in this case, is 1 over 2 r squared. And then the value of the quadratic Casimir of this field, of the fundamental representation, so that actually turns out to be 1, that you can just compute. So you get 1 over 2 r squared, and indeed, when you set r squared equal to 1, then this is 1/2. So that maps nicely to this fundamental multiplet that we use. So that's nice. So now we wonder, can we actually do this for all the multiplets at the same time? And so that's sort of the upshot of this whole part. So the result here is, so what you can do is you take this partition function here at large volume, for instance, and now you have to kind of decompose it so that you kind of, for each multiplet, I mean, each transformation behavior, you have to list all the fields that transform in the same way. So that's known as Casimir decomposition. So you take this thing, and if you're very good, and I think that I should really attribute to my student Mitev, who actually did this. He did the entire decomposition of this thing. So he wrote this as a sum over representations of OSP42. With some branching functions depending on lambda on the representation, but not on the charges. All the charge dependence is now in the characters. C1, C2, C3. So these are OSP42 characters. Just of the finite dimension representation of OSP42. So that you can do. So then, of course, this result on the quasi-abelian evolution suggests that it's very easy now to write down for this open case, write down the partition function at any radius. So all you have to do is you take any radius, you take sum of all representations. So these functions are all explicitly known. There's a nice formula for this. And so all you have to do is you put in Q to the 1 over 2 r squared times the quadratic Casimir of lambda. So that's the proposal then, of course, for the partition function at any radius. And so you evaluate this at r equal 1, and you find that you exactly reproduce this partition function, term by term. And you see, I mean, all these multiplets here, I mean, this infinite number of zero energy multiplets, they kind of all start moving up and eventually give something that ranges nicely into the representation content of an affine OSP algebra. So that's my take on this duality. It's not using S matrices, and sort of it's a somewhat different technique that somehow has to do, of course, with the target space supersymmetry. So that maybe is an interesting aspect of it. It's a technique that, of course, doesn't work for bosonic targets because it's very crucial. It depends on these properties of superalgebras. So
it only gets formal. There's no non-formal generalization of bosons.
I mean, of course, whenever I said that, whenever you compute scalar quantities, I guess there should be some version of this. But of course, somehow, yeah, okay, maybe the take on this is, you see, it was related to this property of the superalgebras that FABs, I mean, that they had this vanishing dual Coxeter number, which more or less gives conformal invariance, right? So I think it's kind of closely related to these conformal cases. There is a few cases which are not quantum conformal where the numerator group has the same property, but I suspect that it also would be broken by quantum effects. So I think it's really sort of tied to the conformal case.
Is there a similar formula to go back from that?
Yeah, you can do the other way. In fact, that's what we first did because we had more experience coming from the Vesomino point and doing so. There we have also stronger arguments. I mean, sort of we had this quasi-abelian evolution be proved first coming from that side, and so you can do it the other way around. Okay, so I'm realizing that now we are at 1 hour, so I have a little bit on the CP models. And okay, good. So then I'll talk about this unless there's more questions. So that concludes sort of what I had to say about the superspheres. Obviously, you could wonder in particular what to do with closed spectrum. I mean, without boundary conditions. There's some issues there that I could also discuss, but maybe we just continue to the next case at the end. So, I think I should say, also these lattice computations, they very nicely show this quasi-abelian evolution in this model. I mean, you can see it very beautifully how all the conformal weights go with this according to this formula. So.
So this theory is integrable in the strong sense that you actually can calculate the answer.
Well, let's say, if you say if you want all quantities, then probably not. But if you're just interested in the scalar conformal dimensions, then yeah, it's integrable as I just showed you. I mean, you can compute it. I don't think, as I said before, I mean, when you're interested in three-point functions, for instance, I'm not sure.
But that's also true of other integrability.
Right. So we can talk about this also a bit later. So maybe we can talk about this also at the very end. I mean, what I imagine how it could pop up, but so let's talk briefly about this other example. That's the chiral field on the projective superspace. So that was the other example of compact backgrounds with supersymmetric conformal and no Vesomino term. So let me recall the description of the space. So we want to construct a superversion of complex projective space. So you all recall how to do this, of course, for the bosonic case. So we have a multiplet Z alpha that contains, now this time it's complex coordinates, ZA and eta A, let's say. So these are bosonic and fermionic, and there's so A runs from 1 to n, so we have n complex coordinates, both bosonic and fermionic. And so we impose the constraint rho squared is equal to that alpha bar. Set this to 1, that's of course not everything. We still have to, there's a U1 that we have to divide out. So we have to divide by an extra U1. And so how does that U1 act? So when we have a phase and take a multiplet set A, eta A, and act on this, and of course it should be omega that A, omega eta A. So that's this U1 action that we divide by. And then we get a super version of complex projective space. And the number of fermions is basically necessary in order to get this, the corresponding Sitka model conformal. So so the action in this case, Cp, is this, and then of course you can in principle also add a feature angle. So there's an extra field in here, that's the gauge field, non-dynamical gauge field. So this D here is D plus IA. So there, that's the way to construct this model. So you have basically a two-parameter family. There's a theta angle, and there's of course our volume parameter R squared that controls for the volume of the complex projective space. So in this case, that gives a two-parameter family of CMTs with C equal minus 2. Okay. So so now you can do the same things that we did before. I'm going to kind of go through it a little quicker this time and do your state counting at large volume. Yes?
Is the twister string theory written?
We don't have Walsheet supersymmetry. Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, I guess it's the same thing. If you would put an extra Walsheet supersymmetry, then it would be a... So you can do the state counting at large volume. I mean, you really think that, yeah, basically you would do the same thing all over again. So state counting at large volume is similar to what we did before, except now we also have this gauge, U1 gauging to take into account. So that adds in a little bit more. But so the formula, so that states at R to infinity, again with Norman boundary conditions. And I focus on the case n equal 2, which would be a CP 1-2. So have a bosonic two-sphere as a base and then four extra fermionic directions. So so then the state counting gives the following. So now there's contributions. I'll not separate zero-mode coordinate excitations. I put it all in one formula. You understand more or less how this goes. So this has a central charge minus 2. So there's a standard prefactor. Then there's again an Euler function. So this Euler function actually takes locally the gauging into account. And globally, the gauging is taken into account. Well, you introduce some extra parameter, and then you have a contour integral around 1. So then you also have the constraint. So again, locally it's taken into account by multiplying with the number Euler function. And globally, it's taken into account by our standard trick using multiplying with n minus t squared and setting t equal to 1 in the end. And then you get, well, the product n equals 0 to infinity. Now I include the 0 more part. That's why the product runs from n equals 0. Then I multiply over alpha and beta, alpha beta plus minus 1/2. So in this case, of course, we have four fermions and four bosons before we impose the constraints. So there will be four factors. And again, there's in this case two charges because the symmetry is PSL22 in this case, so there's two Cartan elements in there. Those appear here. So you have 1 plus y alpha c u minus 1 beta u to the n. That's the fermionic contribution, 1 minus x alpha du beta u to the n. And then I evaluate it with the condition that whenever I see a q to the 0, I actually call that t. And so that's taken. So again, we could discuss it. But I think it's fairly clear. So there's four factors, fermionic, four bosonic factors. And there's this extra value u, basically, that is taken out in the gauge. So there's two charges left. And then you can expand again. And you'll find very nicely, of course, an infinite number of dimension zero fields. This time they're all organized in multiplets of PSL22. And again, you can do this nice trick of decomposing the entire story with representations of PSL22. So you can write this as a sum of representations, and you have these branching functions. So these are different branching functions, of course, depending only on Q. So they are a branching function for CP. Again, they're explicitly computable, and they get multiplied with characters of, so this is now PSL22 characters. Okay. So everything here, up to here, is explicitly known. So now you do what I said before. You do Sickle model perturbation theory. You look at all the terms. You find the same cancellation mechanism. So you have quasi-Boolean evolution. So you take this formula and can immediately write down the partition function at any radius. So any radius is... Well, that's the answer. I mean, doesn't tell you much, but in principle, it's a nice formula. Everything in this formula is explicitly known, so you can compute the spectrum. So now, in fact, I should say that again, we also put the viewer in a lattice. We did lattice simulations, very nicely confirms this quasi-Abelian evolution, so everything seems fine. So, and now you can wonder, what's the dual? So again, I should use my little trick and ask the audience, what do you expect the dual is? So this time I should give you a bit more time, I guess. So that you would know the answer, it would be quite helpful. In fact, I have to admit, I don't know the answer at this point.
What's the lowest dual?
We don't know another. So, I mean, at this point, I mean, we see, okay, so let me, I was hoping basically when the nice Californian sun, I would actually sort of bring this answer to light, but then it was raining all weekend. So I don't know the answer yet. So we have this partition function. We know lots of points where there's new degeneracies. And we have a certain suspicion which point would have a free field description. And of course, in fact, in the condensed matter community, there's this idea that it should actually be described by a PSL22 level 1 Vesomino model. And the rationale, as far as I understand, is think of the bosonic model. If you have a CP1 at theta equal pi, we know that it flows to an SU2 level 1 theory. So somehow, maybe this should be upgraded here, and there should be a PSL22 level 1 Vesomino point. I think that we can now rule out from our formulas. There's just no point that has this. But there's probably some neat free field representation. So yeah, unfortunately, I cannot present you the answer. I mean, it can just sort of remains as a challenge to everybody in the audience. I've played around with it a bit. And I think the formulas are explicit enough to actually come up with something. So I'm pretty sure it can be. I mean, first of all, I'm fairly convinced that there is some free field description. There's one difference, actually, in this model that might make things a little more complicated, is that the symmetric brains, there's actually an infinite family of those, because you can have these monopole bundles on the CP1. So that might actually kind of complicate the things a little bit. I cannot give you the answer, but I would, of course, be happy if somebody has a good proposal to test it, because for sure we can just test it within just a few minutes.
Non-perturbative terms?
Yeah, that's another issue, to which extent there would be non-perturbative. In the lattice simulations, we don't see, up to a certain point, we don't see any non-perturbative contributions with open boundary conditions. So it very nicely follows the perturbative computation.
There are
instantons. I think it's not quite clear how far they sort of propagate into this bulk spectrum. And the lattice computation, also should say, they break down at a certain, I mean, we have a lattice model up to, I mean, also for the supersphere, in fact, that also goes only to a certain point. And then the lattice simulations are just numerically not good enough anymore. So I'm not sure. So there might be something with the instanton, there might be something with these monopole bundles. But I think it's sort of, it's interesting to figure out.
In the previous case, when you have the lattice simulation, yes, you could see two points where one term becomes zero or the other term.
Yeah, that's similar here.
So you can guess at which value of this delta parameter.
Yeah, I think we have a fairly good idea where that point should sit, yeah.
And at that point, what's the lowest dimension field?
Oh, it's zero. So everything is positive. I mean, and but it's a 16 plet, and that kind of is a little difficult. So I don't know. I'm sure there is a story, and I think probably a future occasion. Maybe next week I could have given you the answer. Maybe not.
No. There's no fermion. You don't expect a sort of fermion though to this scale.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've played around. I mean, of course, I've played with the same rules. I mean, take all the bosons, make them fermions, all the fermions taking bosons. If you do this game, you actually see that the central charge always comes out wrong. So that was actually working quite easily in the previous case. Remember this little computation of central charge. So that somehow always comes out wrong when you do this. So I don't quite know how to fix it, but I'm sure it is possible. And so maybe somebody has intuition. Like when I talked to Nathan last week, I sort of looked at his duels. And I thought, okay, there were certainly some tricks I haven't tried yet. So.
What about the n equal 1 case? I mean, you made some headway before with looking at the lowest.
Yeah, so you could look at, I mean, n equals 1 means, oh, the lowest,
zero.
Oh, sorry, yeah,
zero
yeah. Sure, yeah, sorry. N equals 1 is somewhat trivial. In this case, there's no bosonic base. You just have two fermions. It's a free field theory. It has Vesomino point. I mean, there's no parameter, and it's always a Vesomino model. So that you can take that also as an indication that there should be some kind of Vesomino symmetry somewhere in the higher end case. But the theory is trivial. It's basically just a ghost system, free ghost system at C equal minus 2. So that's not rich enough to see anything. That's, of course, yeah, it's good. Of course, in the previous case, the S equal 1 case was actually, or S equal 0 case was actually quite useful as an analogy. Here, sort of, it fails to give any indication. So I can't, at this point, I can't put all these pieces together to get something, but I'm sure it's possible. So let me basically conclude now by mentioning a few problems to be addressed. I said already, I mean, of course, I expect that one could start studying non-compact cases. In fact, we have studied this quasi-Hilbertian evolution for non-compact examples related to ADS3 already. So that's an obvious extension also, of course, to include this fermionic Vesomino terms that appear in these Z4 orbifolds. I think that should be possible to do. Another issue that we've looked at a little bit is the issue of three-point function. Of course, we know somehow that in this context you would expect that certain three-point function might be sort of protected. And that's what we also see in ADS. And Super-Yang Mills, that there's some kind of protection of certain three-point function. As I said, there's certainly no quasi-Abelian evolution in the three-point couplings, but we have kind of computed three-point function at both sides in the supersphere case, and we also see that certain three-point functions agree if they come from a protected multiplet. So that would be some, and again, the analogy could be sort of, I mean, in the world sheet supersymmetry case, of course, you have topological twist, and so you have a lot of tools there to compute things. So somehow, again, there seems to be some kind of similarity, but of course, there's no story of a topological twist at this point. So then, of course, it would be interesting to find a more systematic way of predicting dualities. I mean, the first way was quite nice. The second one I already failed. It would be really nice to have something more universal. I mean, a bit of this type of, well, I mean, I guess in the n equals 2 supersymmetric, world sheet supersymmetric case, I mean, with Witten's paper on the phases in n equals 2, so there was a very systematic way to guess the duality. Something like this is sort of lacking. Then another thing, of course, I was asking, what's the relation to ADS-DFT? And okay, this is certainly sort of a far stretch at this point. So of course, when I do this state counting here at large volume, that's sort of what corresponds to the supergravity side, basically. That's kind of just computing states in supergravity. The other side that I looked at the Gross-Navier model side would then correspond to sort of a free dual of free Young-Mills theory somehow, right? So that would be a state counting on that side. We know that we can write down formulas, but they don't look two-dimensional yet. So I think in some sense that's close to what Nathan is suggesting, that there should be some kind of free field description of this, or topological field theory description even, of this free Young-Mills theory. And in that sense, sort of, I think it has at least some kind of similarity with what you would expect there. And so maybe one could actually detect, I mean, or use arguments similar to this to conjecture or then establish dualities of the type that, in particular, in this pure spinner formulation, Nathan has kind of put forward. And in fact, some of the dualization rules look a little similar to what we have. So that might be a thing. But obviously, that's sort of a far way to go. Other aspects, of course, will be the aspect that also we talked about, quantum integrability and in particular integrable deformations. What, for instance, happens when we do a mass deformation in this supersphere case? I mean, is there some kind of extension, Sine-Gordon massive Turing duality of this type? Then the issue of S matrix, I mean, that's all things that could be studied. So on the whole, I kind of want to wrap up things and say I think we had quite some fun with these models, and I hope kind of saw that they're convinced that they actually have some nice properties too. And as I said, I mean, I suppressed all the weird ones for you to enjoy this more. Okay, thank you.
So just one nasty question. What weird things did you suppress?
So when I first studied these things, I mean, yeah, so in particular, Uwe Salleur, and I guess also Didina, they said, okay, you will find logarithms on the worksheet. And so that's really also the first thing I just saw. We started looking at these models and there were logarithms all over. Okay, and that's something that, I mean, most people don't like, right? And I think that was probably roughly around the time when I was at KITP last time. I don't think I talked about it here, but so there were lots of logarithms. And it's actually interesting. It's also related to supersymmetry. So some of the logarithms come with the supersymmetry. But they don't show up in this story. And basically, the reason is, so the logarithms have to do with the fact that the worksheet Hamiltonian is not diagonalizable. So in this study, we only looked at the diagonalizable part. But there is also a non-diagonalizable, nilpotent piece. Yes, exactly. So this quasi-abelian evolution only computes the eigenvalues. It does not capture anything about this. So from this formula that I gave you, you can actually not really say, I mean, details of the multiplets that appear. I mean, in particular, there's in supersymmetry, you have these short multiplets, and they can come together and form bigger structures. And that's all not captured by what I talked about. So when you take traces, then that never shows up. So in computation of partition functions, it's completely irrelevant. But somehow there is more structure in these theories, actually probably also usable structure. But that's sort of the nasty part. That's logarithms on the worksheet. And so I guess, yeah. I noticed it for sure over the last years that were not very popular.
Nikita's stuff, he also has logarithms.
Yeah, some people like logarithms. No, I mean, I didn't try today. I've tried a few times to make the logarithms sound really positive. And it's possible to some extent. I think there's some structure in, well, as we know, and it's tied to these features of superalgebras and short multiplets and things like this. And then can you imagine, in particular, when you combine worksheet and target space supersymmetry, this could actually become very powerful for reasons that I guess I can't explain here. But there's some nice things about these algebras that are not semi-simple, and you can build very interesting algebraic structures from them. And huge infinite dimensional multiplets, even though the irreducible representations of each individual part is only finite dimensional. So that's actually an interesting thing. So that could be useful, but I don't have anything very convincing to show that would convince everybody that they are really.
These logarithms are because the dimension operator is in Jordan normal form and not diagonalizable, or are these different logarithms?
Yeah, that's basically how you detect them. I mean, when you have the L0 and the L0 bar in the conformal field theory and they have these nilpotent pieces, I mean, just can be brought into Jordan normal form, then you have logarithms.
But all your dimensions were nice.
And I mean, I only showed the nice part, right? So I basically, from this thing, I only showed the thing because I was just interested in traces, so I didn't have to bother about the not nice part.
So you can't really construct delta, the operator.
Yeah, that's not possible, yeah. But I mean, it's very much, I mean, yeah. So there's nilpotent pieces that is enough captured by this quasi-abelian evolution. So the details of the multiplet structure actually depend on that, but the partition function. No, we haven't solved it. No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, somehow our intention was also not really to solve it, but to detect these exactly solvable points in moduli space, and then to do perturbation theory around those exactly marginal, exactly solvable points. It's much more ambitious, of course, to solve the theory. And then, of course, when you really want to solve that, maybe the logarithms are actually in the way. And then, of course, somehow when you apply that to string theory, due to physical state conditions, they should be thrown out in some way. So maybe it's not so important to worry about logarithms in the end, but that I don't know. But yeah, certainly we haven't solved these models.
So these denominators, the thing I asked you before,
So one loop, if the beta function vanishes for any denominator, right? So for example, un n, if you divide.
Yeah, I think it's a two loop that you get extra conditions. Yeah.
So suppose you will achieve supersymmetry, then you have more freedom in the denominator, right?
Right. Yeah.
It will vanish for the other loop.
It could be. I mean, I know that we discussed about it. We have looked a little bit into supersymmetry, but I don't have very convincing things to say about it right now. I don't know whether you could prove it. I mean,
I guess another reason to watch you supersymmetrize is because you have non-unitary things here that some
right.
you have to get rid of.
Right. No, I think it would be actually interesting to watch you supersymmetrize. And in fact, even with the supersphere case, I guess when you take the sphere sigma models and supersymmetrize them, you get a combination of a sphere sigma model and a Gross-Naveau model. And so you could wonder about some kind of self-duality in this context. And so I think there's actually interesting things to study. We just didn't have the time to kind of look. And we have started a little bit to look into supersymmetrizing them, and in particular look into when we get extra n equals 2, just putting in n equals 1 explicitly, and then get n equals 2 cases. So there are lots of interesting things about that. But yeah, I have no more things to say about this.
Yeah. I'm slightly surprised, just from the geometric point of view, that you would have a family of spheres and a family of projective spaces, but no family of quaternionic projective spaces. Is there no way to supersymmetrize those guys and make a third example for you?
Yeah. I think the answer is no, but yeah, maybe I can tell you in the afternoon what the story there was. Yeah. I mean, they appear at some point, and then they drop out again, but I forgot why.
I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.